ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Is AUKUS a good deal or not? Now, the deal was struck in the middle of September 2021, and it was preceded by secret negotiations between the three Anglosphere partners, Australia led by Scott Morrison, the UK by Boris Johnson, and Joe Biden as the then US president. Scott Morrison had told the French that the existing deal in place for Australia to purchase French conventionally powered subs was now off. Then when Labor came to power and Anthony Albanese became Prime Minister, rather than, as some expected, looking to review the AUKUS deal, the new government endorsed the project quite firmly and strongly and continues to do so. But a new critical examination of AUKUS has been published and many people have doubts. It brings to the new examination, one of the co-editors is Professor Mark Beeson, brings together a diverse range of scholars to examine the deal, the politics involved, and place it in the global military and geopolitical context. Mark Beeson is an adjunct professor at the Australia-China Relations Institute at UTS in Sydney, formerly Professor of International Politics at the University of Western Australia. And he joins us this evening. Mark, good evening to you.
Good evening to you, Philip.
Also joining us for the other side of the fence, as it were, is Jennifer Parker. Now, Jennifer's an expert associate at the Australian National University's National Security College, an adjunct fellow in naval studies at the University of New South Wales in Canberra. She served for over two decades in the Royal Australian Navy as a warfare officer and is also an international fellow at the London-based Council on Geostrategy. And is the principal and founder of Barrier Strategic Advisory. She joins us too on Nightlife. Jennifer, good to have your time and expertise. Thanks and welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks for having me on.
Okie doke. Mark, can we start with you? As I mentioned, the September 2021 deal was preceded by a fair bit of secrecy. Suddenly the French submarines contract was broken. The French President Emmanuel Macron famously summing it up in this way.
I have a lot of respect for your country. I have a lot of respect and a lot of friendship for your people. I just say when we have respect, you have to be true and you have to behave in line and consistently with this value.
Do you think he lied to you?
I don't think. I know.
Yes, I don't think I know. It sort of entered the political lexicon, didn't it? Mark, from the research you and other contributors have done since reading between the lines, how do you think the AUKUS deal came about? Why did it appeal and why was it so enthusiastically accepted by both major sides of politics?
Yeah, I think there's a sort of short-term and a long-term answer to this question. I mean, the long-term answer is that Australia's strategic profile and interests have always been wedded to what was famously called a great and powerful friend by Bob Menzies. Mm-hmm. And it used to be the British and now it's the Americans, and it has been for getting on for 80 years. So it's almost literally unimaginable for our political leaders and the strategic advisors who they take notice of to think of anything else other than going along with the Americans preferably, and second best, the POMs will do. So that's been the historical trait, and I don't think anything has changed in that. I think what was remarkable about the AUKUS initiative, though, was we were already, as your little segment showed, aligned to get a deal with the French, buy perfectly serviceable submarines from them, which most strategic analysts think would have been fine for our particular needs, which we can talk about in more detail if you want to. But I think the real thing that appealed to Morrison, of course, was the fact that he was coming up to a federal election. He wasn't travelling that well. And the chance of wedging the Australian Labor Party on security issues, which they feel particularly vulnerable about and are always concerned that they're going to look, quote-unquote, weak on security, this was something that he couldn't really pass up. And the idea that Morrison would have misled the French, would have lied to people, was not an entirely surprising outcome given what we know about Morrison in retrospect. So there are a lot of things floating around that help to explain why this was such an attractive thing.
Are you really saying that the whole thing was just a political wheeze, a political wedge? Surely,
I think that was the icing on the cake, as it were. I think some senior members of the defence establishment in Canberra certainly had doubts about the naval proposition from France, because they're not familiar with the French as a partner in these kinds of processes, and because they would have preferred to do something either with the British or possibly with the Americans. And the Americans are going to be a big ask, because they were very reluctant to transfer their secret nuclear technology, and Joe Biden had serious reservations about proliferation. But Morrison took it upon himself to try and sell this idea to Biden and Johnson at a meeting of the G7 just before the election. And they were kind of interested. And then it started to gain a bit of momentum to the point where they called off the French deal and went full on with the AUKUS Act.
Why do you think Labour jumped so enthusiastically jumped into the side of support for this deal? I mean, they've never questioned it, and
no, indeed,
and now are enthusiastic supporters of it.
And it was waved through within a matter of hours by Albanese in particular, with a perfunctory sort of support from the cabinet. No discussion with the wider Labour Party, and absolutely no discussion at all or information as far as the general public was concerned. So we were all left in the dark. Nobody knew quite what was going on. But Albanese was frightened to death that he might get wedged by Morrison on what looked like an Achilles heel, if that's appropriate metaphor, perhaps. And he was desperate to ensure that this didn't open up a weak spot in the forthcoming election.
What's wrong with it, though? After all, Australia's an island nation. We need naval deterrence. We need naval capability. From all reports, the Virginia-class submarine is the most potent naval weapon in the world. What's wrong with the arrangement?
Okay, well, there's a number of ways of attacking that particular problem. First off, most serious analysts seem to think that ordinary non-nuclear powered submarines would be fine for our particular needs, because we're an island continent. We've got an awfully big moat surrounding us. We're a long way from centres of conflict and possible war. And so there's not really an overwhelming argument for us investing a huge amount in these kinds of weapons, particularly when, I mean, the reality is, if China, and this is always the ghosts at the feast, it's always about China, even if we don't say so, but if China is not deterred by America's overwhelming military might and preponderance, they're not going to be influenced in the slightest by us having possibly three or more submarines of any sort, even nuclear ones. So it's going to make absolutely no difference.
Jennifer, can I bring you in here? Tell me why it's a good deal. Why, from a military strategic point of view, this is the best option and better than, well, at one stage we were going to buy Japanese submarines under the Abbott government, and then French submarines under Mr. Morrison, and now these American Virginia class submarines. Tell me why this is a good idea.
Yeah, look, thanks, Phil. Look, I guess the first point I have to make, with no disrespect, Mark, most of the things that you've just asserted, I think, are fairly speculatory and verging on the inaccurate. So, yes, of course, there are political discussions.
You don't have to be so polite, Jen.
I absolutely respect the contribution, but I think it's important just to be honest, and the Australian people really do deserve a frank conversation about where we are strategically and how we need to respond to that. Setting this up as an Anglosphere agreement, look, we do acquire most of our defence capability, whether you're talking about missiles or whether you're talking about ships or combat systems on ships, from the United States. That's a long-standing defence relationship. So it does make sense that we would look to get our most exquisite submarine capability from the United States. The reason we didn't go down that path initially when it came to the French submarines is because the United States doesn't produce conventional submarines, nor does the UK.
We've never bought US submarines, have we?
So no, because they have not produced conventional submarines since World War II. And so it was always of the view that nuclear-powered submarines wasn't politically appropriate or acceptable in Australia. The debate about nuclear-powered submarines, actually debate starts since the 1960s for Australia, right? It's a conversation not about the threat of China or whoever we're focused on at the moment. It's a conversation about how do you protect Australia, which is quite a unique country in terms of not only the size of its maritime domain, third largest exclusive economic zone in the world, but also its dependency on maritime trade. So the fifth largest user of shipping in the world. So when you think about the protection of Australia, you're not thinking about the protection of the territory. You're thinking about the protection of our dependencies, which includes maritime trade. And when you think about a conventional submarine, which Australia has operated for a long time, we are limited in the ability to maneuver those submarines around our maritime domain. So, for example, a Collins-class submarine dive to get from Perth to Sydney would take 9 days. Mm-hmm. A nuclear-powered submarine would take 4.5 days. And to be honest, if you wanted to go at maximum speed, at less than 3 days.
No.
It's a conversation around geography and what is the most appropriate capability. Now, of course, between the 1960s and now, no Australian government ever asked for that capability, and the US government wasn't going to support that. What has changed? Two things have changed. One, of course, the concern around China and China's behaviour in our region, some of their aggression in our region towards our aircraft and ships in the South China Sea, but also the behaviour towards the Philippines around Taiwan. The second thing that has changed is that conventional submarines are easier to detect on long transits. So when a conventional submarine, a submarine that is powered by diesel propulsion, has to transit, it does so on batteries. When it needs to recharge those batteries, which it does regularly if it's going at maximum speed, it needs to snort, which means come up, get some oxygen, run its diesels and recharge its batteries.
Mm-hmm.
Over the long distances that these submarines travel, every time you snort, you're exposing yourself to detection. And I know a little about this. I'm not an international relations professor, but I am an anti-submarine warfare specialist.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the advent of AI, which assists in detection, these submarines are becoming more and more vulnerable over long distances. So if you're a country like Japan or even South Korea and you want to operate close to your coast, a conventional submarine is absolutely appropriate. If you're a country with a maritime domain of Australia, it is increasingly exposed. So if we were going to go down the path of the French submarines, which, look, cheaper than AUKUS, but actually was going to be $235 billion as of the last time stated in Senate estimates in 2020. So people often say, well, it's $90 billion for French submarines and $368 for AUKUS. It's not actually true.
No.
$90 billion for French submarines for acquisition, another $145 for sustainment, which is $235. Now, that was out to 2080. It was acknowledged in Senate estimates in 2020 that that was an underestimate and it probably would be more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to invest hundreds of billions of dollars into a capability that you know is increasingly vulnerable to detection in the way we operate it. So it makes a lot of sense. Now, of course, there are pros and cons to nuclear-powered submarines. They are more expensive, of course. They also require a larger crew. And there is a question about whether it does distort the focus from the Navy and the ADF onto that capability.
Hmm.
But it is the appropriate capability for Australia. And to take the point that Mark says that most serious analysts agree that we only need conventional submarines, that's absolutely not true. Now, I'm not an international relations specialist, but I know a lot about naval warfare and submarines. Most people would agree that nuclear-powered submarines are the most appropriate capability for Australia. There is just a question about whether that is cost prohibitive or not.
Why didn't we seek them in the past? Sorry, Mark, you go.
Can I jump in and ask a question then?
Mm-hmm.
So how about a couple of questions from a non-series commentator on submarine warfare? So you mentioned about the possibility of detection. My understanding is that drone technology is moving along so quickly that any submarines, be they nuclear or conventional, will be very easy to detect in the future, in the very near future, and people are talking now about the transparent ocean because there'll be literally no place to hide, no matter how sophisticated some of these submarines are. So that's one question. The other question is, if having submarines is such an amazing deterrent capability for Australia or any other country for that matter, why aren't the Chinese taking advantage of the fact that we've only got one submarine, Collins-class submarine, that seems to be capable of going to sea at any time? Surely, if they were really keen on this sort of thing, they'd be wanting to take advantage of that now and cause trouble in the region for us. Of course, they're not.
Let's take the first question first, Jennifer, in relation, because this is an issue, something gets raised all the time, isn't it, that out of the Ukraine experience, etc., and the development of drone warfare and the ghost sharks, which Defence Minister Miles was talking about recently, that the ocean will be transparent, that any submarine will be easily detected. What's your view about that?
No, I think this is a really important question. And Mark, I wasn't calling you an unserious commentator at all. I was saying you're an international relations specialist, you know, and if I was going to get advice on cancer, I'd speak to an oncologist. I wouldn't speak to a gynecologist, if you get my point. So when we talk about transparent oceans, look, this is a really important question. I think a lot of your listeners are probably thinking this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, technology is changing this, right? And there was a paper that came out from the National Security College in Australia about 10 years ago that talked about this idea of a transparent ocean. The ocean is actually really difficult to detect things in. It is quite opaque. And, you know, 11 years ago, I was actually the N3, so the current operations manager, searching for MH370 in the Indian Ocean.
We haven't found it, right?
And a lot of people are confounded because they say, how could we not have found it? The thing you need to understand about the ocean is, how do you primarily detect things in the ocean? Primarily, it's by using sound. So either passively, which is listening to what is making sound, or actively, which is putting sound in the water, bouncing it off something, getting that sound back, measuring the time taken, and understanding the distance. Mm-hmm. Now, sound, and this is going to be a boring conversation, but hopefully helpful, sound actually attenuates or dissipates really easily in water. So your ranges aren't that great. Now, when we go to the MH370 example, they said, well, how couldn't you find the black boxes? So black boxes use a high frequency, which means it dissipates through water quickly. Mm. So sound is actually really, it is the best way to detect things underwater, but it's actually quite hard and you don't get significant ranges. It's also affected by things like temperature changes in the water column. So you might put sound into the water to look for a submarine, but there'll be a temperature change below you, which means it'll bounce off the top of that layer instead of penetrating it. Hmm. So it's actually quite challenging. It's quite a science to try and work that out.
So you think, Jennifer, that it's exaggerated, that the ocean's not as transparent as people claim?
So I think it's exaggerated. I think certainly with some satellite technologies in the littoral, so which is closer to the coast, mm-hmm. yes, absolutely, it will become easier. I think you will have more capabilities that can use sound underwater. But the idea that it will become transparent in the near, medium, or long term, I actually find fanciful. And I say that as someone who has spent a lot of time thinking about how you use sound in water to detect things. Okay. But yes, closer to the coast, are things going to become more vulnerable? Yeah, that is likely, potentially near choke points, which is where land constricts the water. But in the larger deep oceans, no, that's actually quite unlikely at this point. Now, of course, the proliferation of drones will change the ability to access the water column and operate in the water column, but you're still coming against the same challenge in terms of the distance you can actually detect things in underwater. Okay. So the idea of a transparent ocean, I think, is highly unlikely.
Okay. Mark, you can respond to that if you like.
Well, I just think that how can we possibly predict anything 10 years from now, never mind 20 or 30 or however long these subs are ever going to take, if they ever arrive, of course. So I think that's not something we want to put too much confidence in, particularly given the amount of money we're spending on these.
I think, with due respect, Jennifer probably has answered that question, saying that lead times on these things are long for all countries. Can I put this question to you, Jennifer, which is a question that Mark has put as well, and a lot of people are sceptical about, and that is, we're supposed to get these three Virginia-class submarines. I think the deal is, in the end, up to five, isn't it, Virginia-class submarines from the US? But the build rate by US shipyards is below the level at which those things would become available. What do you think about this argument, which is along the lines of, we're never going to get them anyway?
Well, I don't think it's correct to say we're never going to get them anyway. I think people are right to have concerns about the US submarine industrial base, and in fact, the shipbuilding industrial base. Mm. But you've got to understand, so when did they start building the Virginia-class submarines, which is their main attack submarine they operate, and that is the type of submarine, nuclear-powered submarine, that we intend to buy in the 2030s. So with the first one arriving in 32, then 35, then 38, before we start building our own. When they started building in 1998, they said they wanted to build two a year. Mm-hmm. So they had produced 40 by 2024. They've never met the build rate of two a year. And one of the reasons is because of the setup of their yards to do this, how they've underinvested in it since the end of the Cold War. Now, if you look at the current rates, they're producing about 1.2 of these attack submarines a year. But what is their end goal? What was the 2 or the 1.24? They have a force design plan where they want to operate 66 attack submarines, so nuclear-powered submarines, but not nuclear armed, by 2054. That's their force design plan. Now, to get to that, they've assessed that they do need to be building 2 per year by 2028. So not right now, but by 2028, and that is coming close, and they're not necessarily addressing all their submarine industrial base issues at all. This is a genuine concern. And then to account for the 3 submarines that they would sell to Australia but still get to the 66 by 2054, then they would probably have to build 2.3 submarines per year. Now, they are probably going to be able to increase that rate. Will they get to the 2.3 in a near term? Look, that is unlikely.
Seems unlikely in a year. Seems unlikely in 2 years, doesn't it?
It does. But at no point has the US said, has the US said that if they're not going to be on track for their 66 submarines per year in 66 submarines in their force by 2054, that they wouldn't sell 3 to Australia. And you've got to think about it in terms of what is the, opportunity cost benefit for them. So 66 submarines on paper by 2054, or 63 or 60 or 59, but the ability to operate from HMAS Stirling, which is much closer to the South China Sea, closer to Northeast Asia from mainland US, outside of China's ballistic missile envelope, plus have the ability to maintain those submarines in HMAS Stirling and be supporting a partner to develop their own submarine industrial base. Mm-hmm. And I just think that when you look at that, yes, you might have 63 submarines in 2054 and not your 66, or you might have 62, but you have a whole bunch of other things in terms of access and maintenance that actually increase your overall anti-submarine warfare capability. So a lot of people want to think, well, it's black and white. If they're not going to get to 66 by 2054, they'll never sell us that. But they're not taking into account all of the other factors that actually mean that they have more of a capability in their theatre of choice in their time of choice. So should we be concerned about US submarine production rates? Yes, of course, and that is why the Australian government is investing in US submarine industrial base, and we've seen those checks go across. But is that catastrophic to phase 2 of AUKUS, the sale of 3 Virginia class? No, it's not.
Presumably, Mark, the whole of the Navy can't be wrong about this if they assess that this is the most lethal weapon that's on offer, and if there's a chance to have it, we should.
I'm sure it is a very lethal weapon, but there's a question about whether that's actually what Australia needs to do at this particular historical juncture.
Tell me why not.
The fact that we have 3 of these, I mean, as Miles puts it rather euphemistically, we have impactful projection, i.e. we've got the capacity to kill lots of people in China if we need to in the event of some kind of nuclear conflict or just a conflict over Taiwan breaking out, of which we would have to be a willing participant, of course, because that's what we've always done. And if we've got American submarines, which we've been trained on by the Americans, they'll be part of the American strategic profile. So I don't think there's any doubt that we would be involved in these things. The question is that really a good idea for Australia? And if there are this parade of American submarines and British submarines rotating through Garden Island Base, which is just down the road from where I live, and I don't know if everybody in the area knows that we're now going to be a nuclear target, of course. Don't know if that's been discussed with the local punters. But if we have this rotating force of submarines in and out of the base at Fremantle, do we really need to have any more of our own? Would 3 more of our own, staffed by people probably from the United States, because we don't know how to operate them and don't have the school crews yet, would that make any difference whatsoever to the overall effect that Australians might have in any potential conflict? Or more importantly, and Jennifer hasn't actually answered this question, our deterrence capability. I mean, what are 3 submarines owned by Australians? What difference is that going to make to our kind of...
Let's put the question to Jennifer. Jennifer Parker is with us. She's a naval officer, an adjunct fellow in naval studies at the University of New South Wales, and is on the we should have them side of this argument. And Professor Beeson is putting a more sceptical eye over the project. Jennifer, can you respond to Mark's question there?
Well, I think there was a lot wrapped up in those comments from Mark, and I think a lot of that is quite alarmist in a way. I mean, Australia is not acquiring nuclear-powered submarines so they can attack the Chinese population. I think we need to steer away from those kind of dramatic statements.
Why?
I think they're unhelpful to the conversation. Sorry, I'm happy to answer your question if you want me to continue, but I'm happy to stop as well if you want to interject. So why is Australia requiring nuclear-powered submarines? Mm-hmm. Australia, as a sovereign country, needs to be able to protect its national interests. As I mentioned before, Australia has the third largest exclusive economic zone in the world. It is the fifth largest user of shipping. When you think about the defence of Australia, you're not talking about just the defence of Australia. If you think about Australia almost as a living organism, this is gross, but a living organism with its organs outside of its body, our vulnerabilities exist outside of our territory. Mm. So how do you keep Australia safe from coercion in the maritime domain? It is being able to protect our sea lines of communication.
So you're saying it's defensive, it's not offensive, which...
So I'm very much saying it is defensive. So when you think about the numbers of submarines we're going to acquire, Mark keeps saying three. The answer is not three. The government has stated eight. Now, that is part of a long journey, AUKUS Phase 2 and Phase 3. When you think about naval capability, you have a 3-to-1 ratio generally. If you're an engineer, you'll be offended by this. If you're not an engineer, it makes sense. For every three ships or submarines you have one operational, one in training, one maintenance. Mm-hmm. So eight nuclear-powered submarines, by the time we're operating them, which is now well into the 2040s, early 2050s, that means you have 3 to 4 operational, more likely three. That allows you to operate one in the Pacific Ocean, one in the Indian Ocean, and one available for other tasking. What is that tasking? To be honest, a lot of people have made a lot of the point that submarines can carry cruise missiles. And we've seen US submarines use cruise missiles most recently in attacks on Iran in June and also on the attacks in Houthis in Yemen. Mm-hmm. But submarines don't like employing missiles. In fact, they only do it if you have dominant sea control, so you have the freedom of maneuver. Because when a submarine fires a missile, it gives away its position and it can be attacked.
So what are they like?
Actually,
what are they like firing?
What are the point of?
Go on.
Sorry,
you go on.
What are the point of these submarines? They are to hold any potential adversary that might seek to threaten our shipping at risk. So, to your point, if there is a submarine operating in the Pacific Ocean, you are highly unlikely, in the event of a crisis or conflict, to see a naval task group of a potential adversary operate there because it's too much of a risk. Because submarines have an advantage. That is the role of our submarine. Now, can they do other things? Of course, they can insert special forces. They do a lot of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. But it is about protecting our maritime domain and our sea lines of communication. And I think that often when we have these debates, we get into this conversation about, well, it's about the US and it's about China, it's about this. We are a sovereign nation, and we need to think about our defence. And this capability is in our interest to protect our sea lines of communication.
If we had one, Jennifer, if we had one that was sitting off the east coast of Australia, remember the Chinese little flotilla of, I think it was one of their missile-capable destroyers and two support ships that floated around, that sailed into the Tasman, fired off a whole lot of shots and then continued on around the bottom of Tasmania and then up the west coast of Western Australia. Are you saying they wouldn't do that if there was if we said, look, we've got a sub parked off the east coast?
So I'd say that in the event of a conflict, they would not sail a task group there because submarines have an advantage where they could take out that task group. And so one of the advantages of submarines is it's so hard to know where it is, which is amplified with a nuclear-powered submarine because of the speed at which they travel, that you wouldn't risk putting your naval task group there. Now, just to clarify, though, with the Chinese naval task group, they have every right to operate on the high seas. I know we say that they did this firing close to Australia. They were actually 340 nautical miles from the Australian coast, 140 nautical miles outside of our exclusive economic zone, and they did a medium-range gunnery firing. Warships do medium-range gunnery firings all the time. Right. Now, they did it too close to an air lane. Normally, you should distance yourself 10 nautical miles from an air lane. You shouldn't interrupt the aviation flow. They clearly did. 49 aircraft had to interrupt. But I think that we need to put in perspective that operation. Was it a demonstration? Yes. Was it as aggressive as people say? No. Would they have done that if we had a nuclear-powered submarine? Yes, because we're not about to start shooting their ships. But in the event of a conflict, no, you wouldn't see that naval task group operating there because it would be at risk from a nuclear-powered submarine.
Mark, better bring you back in here. What do you think's a better? What was a better option for Australia here?
I think the conventionally powered submarines, maybe getting a dozen or so of them, which would still have been cheaper than buying the nuclear powered submarines, would have been a better option. Many serious strategic thinkers seem to say, people like Hugh White and Clinton Fernandez and others, Albert Palazzo, who you talked to last week, all of these kind of people think that that's a very sensible option. And we simply don't need to be spending so much money on just a very small number of submarines that may or may not be available at any particular time. So the but the other question that still hasn't been answered is about deterrence. And I mean, what difference will these three submarines really make in terms of deterrence? And why would China want to? It's the biggest trading country in the world. Why would it want to disrupt trade and that will have an even bigger negative impact on it than it would on Australia, probably? What would be in it for China to act in that way?
Although that's a very difficult question, though, isn't it, Mark, to try and predict threats can arise when you didn't predict them.
No, that's very true. But it's worth thinking about which countries are the biggest threat to international security at this particular moment in time. And I think to look at behavior around the world at the moment, it's not obvious that it's China.
Mm. Yeah. Well, one of the questions or criticisms, Jennifer, that's often put too is that, look, this will make Australia permanently enmeshed with the US, and we will effectively become, because of the submarine base in Western Australia, we will become a US base, essentially. That is not the case. America does not have US bases in Australia at the moment. I know there's Pine Gap, which is a communications outfit. I'm using the word base very loosely here, but
Darwin.
Is Darwin a US base?
Rotational forces.
Forces. It's not a US base, though. But
not a US base.
No. That this would in fact mean, though, that Australia would. That America would have a US submarine base in Australia. Is that a fair observation, Jennifer?
Look, I think people are right to have this conversation and be concerned. I wouldn't say it's a fair observation to say it's a base. What is a base? And, of course, bases versus rotational can become political depending on how a government wants to think about these things, right? Mm. But a base means that they have control over the security, the access and the defence of that establishment. The US doesn't have a base in Australia. Now, of course, we are going to see a larger footprint around HMAS Stirling, over 1,000 US sailors as we rotate these submarines through. And that is a large footprint. And there are, questions that the public are going to ask about what does that mean for Stirling and what does that mean for Australia? But the US has had a significant presence in Australia for quite a while. Now, it has ramped up since 2012 in the Force Posture Initiatives, of course, with the Marines that rotate through Darwin. They're not based there permanently, but they do rotate through Darwin. But when we think about the US posture in Australia, to be honest, Pine Gap, which is near Alice Springs, it is a intelligence collection facility, has been a critical facility for the US for a very long time, since it was established in the 70s. The same as Northwest Cape, which we don't talk about a lot, but on the northwest coast of Western Australia. We do have this critical strategic infrastructure that supports the US, supports Australia through the Five Eyes intelligence sharing arrangement. This is a larger footprint. Does it change whether Australia might be threatened in the event of a crisis or conflict? Look, it's hard to predict what a crisis or conflict might be. Mm. But, of course, some of those key bases may well be targets in the event of a crisis or conflict. That is true. That's been acknowledged. I mean, Professor Paul Gibb talks about this extensively, the author of the 87 White Paper, that was a thing that the government thought about when they agreed to Pine Gap, that it would potentially be a target. But the benefit of having that access and that intelligence outweighed that potential risk. To the question that was asked, if I've got time, Philip, just to talk about this, I think that what we're talking about here is what is the appropriate strategy and capability to protect Australia's national interests.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, because we are so dependent on the maritime, that involves projecting force across the maritime through ships and submarines and aircraft. When we talk about deterrence, though, and you made the point, Mark, that three submarines doesn't matter for deterrence. And I guess I would agree with you, too, in a point in terms of, look, AUKUS was initially sold as a strategic deterrent. And I don't think that nuclear-powered submarines are a strategic deterrent. I think that when you think about deterrence theory, there are three critical pillars of deterrence: having a credible force, communicating that you may use that force, and being believed that you would follow through. Now, having a credible ADF, Australian Defence Force, and not just the submarines, the whole gamut of our capabilities, and in fact, a resilient society, does underpin deterrence.
Hmm.
But nuclear-powered submarines are more of an operational deterrent. So what does that mean? It means that, to our point we were making before, a country is not going to sail a maritime task group into an area to threaten your maritime trade if they think there is a risk of a nuclear-powered submarine being there. So it is an operational deterrent. It adds to the credibility of the Australian Defence Force, which underpins strategic deterrence.
Okay. All right. Mark, you've raised points, including how could Australia, one, afford this, and B, how would they ever crew these things in the first place? Do you want to talk to those two issues?
Well, they're different issues, yes. I put my cards on the table that I regard the thing as the whole deal as being woefully misguided and an appalling waste of limited resources in mm-hmm. this country that could be put to much better uses. And it seems to me, and I don't think Jennifer's going to agree with this either, but it seems to me that the biggest problem that this country faces in terms of security is from the climate. And every day we see new unprecedented disturbances in our global environment and our local environment. I mean, Australia has the great privilege of being underwater and on fire at the same time. I mean, clearly something is going profoundly wrong with the environment in which we live. Now, it seems to me we could do something useful with all of this money we're going to spend on these submarines in doing something about making a green transition in this country, which is the biggest threat that we face, in my view, and not to mention having things like social housing and many other things that your listeners can probably think of that the money could be better spent on. But the idea that that would ever be taken seriously or even considered as an alternative to...
Although that's an argument about defence generally, isn't it? You know, we'd spend it on other things. Of course, you could.
Particularly striking example of that kind of thinking, just because of the sheer cost for three submarines that may or may not ever
well,
arrive.
Well, no, that, it's not three. As Jennifer explained, it's up to eight submarines, isn't it?
Maybe.
Well, I guess we need to be careful with the comments around whatever and things like that, because I think facts matter in this conversation. Like, the Australian public deserves to know the facts and make their own judgment. So when we're talking about an investment in nuclear powered submarines, it's not three submarines for $368 billion. It is the investment in the infrastructure, the investment in the workforce, the investment in buying three submarines from the 2030s, and then the investment in building our own submarine industrial base, which then makes us more self-reliant in some ways.
Which we haven't discussed, and that is the AUKUS submarines that are supposed to be following on from the purchases of the Virginias. Can I ask you this question, Jennifer? A lot of critics say the trouble with this also is that it means that it's an erosion of Australian defence sovereignty, because the submarines, the nuclear submarines, would essentially be part of American strategic objectives as well, and we would have less say in how they're deployed. What do you say to that?
Yes, I actually think that's quite inaccurate. And I think that one of the problems with this discussion, look, it's important for all Australians to have a view and have an opinion, but one of the problems with this discussion is it's so often led by people who actually don't understand defence capability or acquisition. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but to my point that I made earlier, you know, I'm not going to see a gynecologist for my cancer treatment, right? I'm going to see an oncologist. So when we talk about this, people say, well, it's eroding sovereignty because of the dependency.
Mm-hmm.
The first point to note is we are quite dependent on the US for acquisition. Stepping away from submarines, the combat systems that our destroyers operate, the missiles that they fire, the missiles that our Air Force fires, the planes that they fly, they are all dependent on the US defense industrial base.
They're all US.
AUKUS doesn't take us further, and we're not having conversations about are our Hobart-class destroyers a sovereign capability or not, despite the fact that we can't update that combat system. The US does that, right? Mm. We don't build those missiles. The US does that. So I think that this debate's been skewed. Yes, is there a dependency in terms of reliance on the US for this? Yes. Is it greater than dependency of reliance on the US for other things? No. Are these submarines more important in the US than just the combat system of the destroyer? Yes, probably, and there is an argument there. When we think about anti-submarine warfare is done on a theatre basis. So when I think theatre basis, across a geography, it's not platform on platform. We do collaborate with the US on anti-submarine warfare. We have for a very, very long time. In fact, our Collins-class submarines have US combat systems on them and have had and regularly have US sailors on them.
All right, fine.
So that doesn't mean that the US isn't telling us where to operate these submarines. It does mean that we're coordinating, but these are Australian submarines commanded by Australian officers.
Okay.
Will they have some US people on it? Maybe, but we already have some US people on Collins subs.
Sure, I get that point. What about if we don't get any, Jennifer? Which is a possibility, isn't it?
You know, look, of course, it is a possibility. I wouldn't say it was a probability because of all the reasons this is in the US's interest. But there is a lesson here for Australia, and this is not thinking long-term and seriously about defence capabilities. So because we delay decision-making on replacement of our ships and replacement on our submarines, decisions that we really should have been making, to be honest, in the early 2000s, I think is striking. The 2009 white paper says we need a plan next couple of years to replace our ships and submarines.
Whose fault was that? Was that the Navy's fault or was it the government's fault?
Look, I think it's subsequent governments deferring decisions or not making correct decisions. So we've gotten to the point, whether we're talking about ships or submarines, that there is no plan B because we're already on plan D. So
if we'd bought the Japanese submarines, we'd have them now. We wouldn't be having this argument, would we?
So maybe. Now, we never actually told Japan we were going to buy those submarines. We did commit to buying the French submarines. The first French submarine was actually meant to be delivered in 2034. Now, if we stick to the current AUKUS timeline, of course, timelines can change. Mm. We actually get the first Virginia 2 years before we would have got the first French submarine, which is often lost in this conversation. So, yes, we should have made decisions a long time ago. We should have made them earlier. If we don't get these submarines in the 2030s, what does it mean? It means a capability gap. Now, how do we fill that capability gap? To be honest, it's probably going to be relying on the US until we can build our own submarines. Yeah.
This is a point that Jennifer's making strongly here, Mark. Does she have a point in the sense that the horse is well and truly bolted on any Australian defence sovereignty anyway? We don't have it and probably haven't had it since the early 60s.
From the point of view of Australia's defence elite community, no doubt Jennifer does have a point, but that's part of the difficulty with this particular issue, it seems to me, that the Australian population, people who are outside of that clubby network of strategic officials and commentators, are not taken seriously at all, don't get much of a look in, are dismissed as being out of touch with the strategic realities that really dictate the kind of behaviour that we should have in the international system. And so consequently, we end up with these incredible lemons that are overpriced, don't act as possible. I asked ChatGPT to run off a list of projects in Australian defence procurements that have gone over budget, have been delayed for years on end. It ran to 2 pages. I won't bore your listeners with it, but this is an astonishing pattern of defence acquisitions in this country that are often useless, don't work as advertised, wildly more expensive than we were ever led to believe, and frequently don't turn up anyway. So we've got a bit of history in this regard, and I think there's a lot of room for people who are interested in public policy, the spending of scarce resources, to have a voice in this kind of thing, because it seems to me, at least, and I'm happy to be put right about this, that the acquisition of 8 submarines won't make a scrap of difference to the strategic calculations of China or the United States, for that matter. Kirk Campbell, a former Biden administration senior security official, said that the AUKUS agreement locks us into 40 years worth at least of American decisions on security and what they want to do, and we won't have any choice other than to go along with it. So I think that does undoubtedly undermine our sovereignty and will place us in a position that we may not want to be, because China is also our biggest trade partner. It's not an aggressive power compared to the United States. Its leadership these days looks a bit more predictable and stable than the leadership of the United States. And these are issues that are simply not even considered in debates about, well, what should Australia do to try to protect its strategic interests? And maybe they're being wildly overstated in the first place. Maybe we could do them much more cheaply and efficiently and by being a good international citizen. And I'm sure Jennifer will be rolling her eyes in her studio at the very notion of that. But it seems to me that if some countries don't actually demonstrate that there are other ways of trying to be secure, trying to think about the future of the planet and the generations that are going to follow, then they won't have much of a future.
But you concede that Australia needs a capable defence force, don't you?
Up to a point. But there's a big debate about how capable, in inverted commas, it needs to be. Right. And it shouldn't just be the pointy heads in Canberra that are calling the literal and metaphorical shots on that issue.
Mm. Jennifer?
Can I just comment there? Firstly, Mark, thank you for calling me defence elite. I'm chuffed. I grew up in Broken Hill and went to Alma Public School and Willie Alma Public School, so I'm not sure that I would classify myself as defence elite, but I am a naval strategist, absolutely. And so I think that we do need to think about, you know, I get your point, and there are good arguments against AUKUS, but I would say that in this conversation you've said we should be more focused on the climate, we should be more focused on housing, China's not a threat. I've got to tell you, the women and men in our maritime patrol aircraft in the South China Sea are experiencing this firsthand, and we got a little taste of it with the circumnavigation of Australia. Hmm. You said we don't need submarines, but we need lots of conventional submarines.
But we routinely
the US is
spy
actually
on
the threat
Chinese.
To Australia. I guess the,
off the coast
I guess
of
the
China.
Point being is I understand that you don't support AUKUS, but you've thrown a whole bunch of things at this, and none of them are necessarily coherent. And you're saying that, oh, well, the pointy heads in Canberra. I'm not a pointy head in Canberra. I'm a girl from a country town who grew up with the time at sea, and having spent my adult life at sea, I do understand naval strategy. And so, yes, there are arguments for and against AUKUS, but we need to be able to protect Australia's national interests. And you can't deny the world is changing. We're seeing conflicts in
undoubtedly.
Europe, conflicts in the Middle East, conflicts between Pakistan and India, and Australia does need to be able to protect itself. And if you're saying that China's not a threat, I've got to say, having spent a lot of time in the South China Sea in the last 10 years, I'd have to disagree with you because I've seen
but
it firsthand.
One thing we know about piling up weapons one after another is that eventually somebody will want to use them. And I think we've been down this road before. I mean, World War One, everybody thought deterrence was working until it didn't. And then we have chaos and mayhem on an unimaginable scale. Mm. And if we don't be very careful, that's where we're going again, because nobody knows what's going to happen around Taiwan and various other issues. And trying to reduce the amount of military hardware in the world seems like a good idea to me.
Okay. Look, we're going to have to go.
I don't disagree, but you've got to remember that China has over 70 submarines.
Jennifer, we have to go.
Thanks, Philip.
And because debates can go on forever, but the news waits for no person. Sorry. including nuclear submarines and their arguments. Jennifer Parker is at the National Security College at the Australian National University, a naval officer for over two decades. She served in the Royal Australian Navy as a warfare officer as well, and she was putting the argument for AUKUS. Professor Mark Beeson from the University of Technology in Sydney, former professor at the UWA, was suggesting there might be another way. Thank you to both of you. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Philip.
Thanks so much, Mark. Thanks, Philip.
Bye. I hope you found that discussion illuminating, certainly spirited, which is the way we like it too.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.